Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to the show. Today's edition of Risky Business is brought to you by the lovely folks at the Big Yellow Box, Symantec. And a big thanks to those guys for paying our bills this week. And we'll be bringing one of the Symantec guys on the show later to talk about this new banking Trojan that sidesteps two-factor authentication. It's pretty nasty. We'll also be taking a quick look at a bit of a consumer issue involving some questionable marketing tactics being used by an anti-spyware software manufacturer. We'll chat with the CEO of NetRegistry, Larry Block, about that one later on. This week's feature interview is with Graham Nielsen of Aura Software Security, and we'll be talking BlackBerries. Aura's developed a Trojan for BlackBerries that he uses in security audits. He describes it as back orifice for the BlackBerry. And if you thought getting badware to run on the mobile device is hard because of code signing and things like that, you are sadly mistaken. But first, as always, it's time for this week's news with our favourite news hound, Munir Kataria, editor of ZDNet Australia. Munir, we've long had a go at Oracle. We've long criticised Oracle for having a huge number of security vulnerabilities.
We have indeed, yeah.
Yeah, we've given them a bit of shtick, but it seems that even when they do patch them, it doesn't seem to matter because most people apparently don't apply the patches anyway.
Well, of course, this is according to a company that deals with the security of Oracle databases, so I don't know if they're going to get anything out of this, you know, or not. But
you think they might have a vested interest in perhaps overplaying the problem?
I think they may do. I mean, okay, let's just go with the story first of all. They say a survey of 305 Oracle professionals, they found that 67.5 of them said they'd never applied an Oracle critical Oracle patch.
67.5%, I think you mean, not 67.5 of them, because
5%. That's what I mean.
0.5 of an Oracle admin. I mean, that's a. I don't think I'd like to see that.
Okay, look, 67.5% of them said they'd never applied a critical Oracle patch, and 90% said not yet applied patches from the most recent critical patch update. God, I can't speak this morning.
Yeah, but I'm struggling as well, mate. I think we're still in the silly season. It's the last hurrah. It's the last week of the silly season.
Oh, God, thank God for summer.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, so they say that, you know, most of these databases are unpatched. But, you know, and it says on the face of it, these survey results look alarming. Well, yes, they do, actually.
But, I mean, seriously, I don't trust surveys done by vendors anymore because we get them shoved down our throat by all these vendors. And isn't it funny how all of the surveys just happen to suggest that, you know, you need product X from the person who did the survey? It would still be quite hard to sort of fudge it that severely. I mean, there would be some data suggesting that some of the data here, when you look a bit deeper, does suggest that some users don't want to run the patches immediately because of downtime and compatibility with applications. So maybe there's a few QA issues with Oracle patches that we're not quite aware of.
Yeah, there could well be. But no, I mean, you know, it's a bit like, you know, you've got your routers, really. You know, people don't really like patching their routers.
Well, people don't like patching. Excuse me, people don't like patching Cisco routers, right? And that's because
that's true, yeah.
Cisco's train system, it's just, man, you know, there's like, you'll have one device and there'll be like 200 different updated images that you can, you know, choose to put on the thing. And if you pick the one that had the, you know, that has an extra port or whatever, you've just balked your whole system. So, yeah, it would be alarming if people aren't patching Oracle, but, mate, there are so many bugs in Oracle databases anyway. I don't think it really matters if people are running patches.
You know? Yeah, you're probably right.
Oh, dear. Anyway.
Let's move on.
Mac users are being targeted by something familiar to PC users, which are one of these free, rogue, you know, security applications which say, we've found a problem on your system, you must download this software. And then, of course, it'll find some problem that, you know, isn't really a problem and say, you have to give us $29.95 or whatever the money is to install this application, or, you know, the internet will eat your children.
It's just a complete con, isn't it? And the Windows guys have been, like, falling for this and being targeted by it for so many years now. It's about time it moved over to Apple, I guess. You know, market share's going up. It's bound to happen.
It's funny that this story pops up over this last week as well, because on the program today you'll hear that an anti-adware mob is using some dubious techniques to market towards Australians. But there'll be a little bit more of that later on in the show.
I look forward to hearing it.
Excellent. Also in the news, Australia has been in talks with the FBI over a global, and I love this term, a global danger base.
It is a good word, yes.
Did you come up with that?
No, it wasn't me.
Oh.
No, I know.
It's a good one, though. So what's exactly going in this danger base?
Well, the UK and Australian police talked to the FBI, and basically they're going to create a whole biometric, they're calling it the Server in the Sky database, to share biometric data, such as fingerprints, iris scans, of international criminals, or rather criminals internationally.
So you and me could be in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, well, we're definitely on there somewhere, aren't we?
They've got our irises. All our eyeballs are belong to the FBI. Yeah, so, I mean, if, you know, well, Howard's gone now, but, you know, conceivably, if we had have got done for thought crime or sedition or, you know, having dangerous thoughts,
We've had a few of those over the year on record.
It's possible that we would have been maybe scanned at the gateway at the airport in the States and hauled off to Gitmo.
Yeah, well, I know they've got my fingerprints over there in the US because I got a media visa, so, you know, you need to give your fingerprints right?
Even if you go in under the visa waiver program now, they still do those little, you know, fingerprint scans on you.
Oh, geez, everyone's getting scanned, huh?
Everyone's getting scanned, you know. It's just we're one step away from the anal probe. Welcome to the brave new world. What do you think of this stuff? Do you think the privacy advocates are getting a little bit too concerned over it, or do you think or do you think they've got a point that this stuff is a bit scary?
Mate, I think it's too late. I think we were all bought and sold, and all of this kind of stuff went ages ago. We totally lost our privacy a while back. I think as soon as we joined Facebook, actually. Look, do you know what? Even if these are the most secure databases in the world, we'd still be in trouble. But, I mean, I wonder what make they are. What do you reckon?
Oracle, maybe?
Okay, let's rewind to the beginning of the show.
Yeah. I'm sure there's going to be issues with all relational databases, whether it's Oracle or what's IBM's DB2.
Yeah.
There's going to be problems with SQL as well. I it is a bit of a worry that we're cramming such sensitive information into such, you know, stinking piles of crap.
And the other point is, I mean, who are the people in charge of these databases? I know there was a story last week we wrote about some US customs people being fired for, you know, taking a bit of cash and then selling the information on the database.
But that happens, everywhere, you know.
Exactly,
I mean, that happens at Roads and Traffic Authority and, or what do they call it in the States, the DMV, and happens at the police, you know, the tax office, everyone.
Yeah, Centrelink, they got done as well sometime last year for that kind of thing. So, I mean, it doesn't matter how secure the system is. If the people are, you know, a bit dodgy, then they...
Although these days there's really much more sophisticated auditing on database lookups. So that's one thing that's clamping down on a lot of that behaviour is people are told every time you look up something, you know, it'll be logged.
Yeah.
So, interesting. Okay, this is a great story about CA, formerly Computer Associates. One of their products had 60 security vulnerabilities in it after being patched.
Yeah, this is the OxServe backup, which, according to Secunia, the vulnerability testing company, they said that they got CA to, you know, they brought up some vulnerabilities, CA patched this product. And then after they patched it, they went and checked it and they found 60 vulnerabilities inside it.
Yeah, it's a poor code with poor design. An internal code review should have revealed problems in the code that needed to be fixed before the product was launched, is what they said. Now, I'm pretty sure ArcServe, I mean, CA has a habit of acquiring a lot of companies. Now, ArcServe wasn't something they developed from the ground up. And you've got to wonder, with a business model like CA's, where you're spending most of your time actually buying developed software with decent install bases, you're going to have some QA trouble across the board because you're going to have different coding conventions between all of these companies that you've acquired.
Yeah, it's one of the big issues, isn't it, when all these companies, I mean, Symantec is in the same boat there where they just keep buying other companies and then they end up with this whole different load of code.
They'd actually licensed Autonomy Keyview,
which
is used in Symantec mail security as a Lotus 1-2-3 file viewer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that can be exploited with a buffer overflow and it's Secunia call it highly critical, which, you know, that's not good. And it was reported on the 12th of December, but the vulnerability's still there. Now, you know, the going theory is that Symantec would love to patch it, but they're relying on a third party to provide the patch.
Yep.
IBM also use this autonomy software. So, yeah, a little bit of a disaster there.
Yeah. Although I'm very, very assured by CA, because in a statement after all of this information came out, CA said it was improving its quality assurance procedures.
Yeah. Oh, good on you guys. Thanks. You know, that's... I'm going to sleep really well tonight. It's a top priority.
It is, yes.
It is. You know, with the way public relations professionals carry on, you'd think it was more important than turning a profit.
You'd think. No, we all know that's not true.
Now, we're actually doing a feature on this. This is our sponsor interview with the guys from Symantec a bit later on. But there's a banking Trojan that's sort of popped up that's quite interesting because it's widespread and it appears to break two-factor authentication.
Yeah, it appears to. Basically it's a Trojan. It installs itself as a .MIDI music player driver on Windows systems, steals passwords and gives you porn, basically.
Yeah, force-fed 600 porn sites to infected PCs, according to security researchers. So it's not exactly a stealthy Trojan, is it? But I guess what makes it installs itself as a .MIDI music player driver, steals passwords, session cookies and digital certs. Now, I guess what's interesting is that it can actually do real-time man-in-the-middle on sites that are using two-factor authentication, but we'll hear a little bit more about that later on in the program. That'll be good.
Cool.
And I think that's it. Is there anything else coming up, Moon?
No, God, not that I know of.
Just maybe a Barocca and a lie down?
I reckon, yeah.
Okay,
thank
mate.
God we got Australia Day coming up. Yay.
All right, Moon, well, thanks a lot for your time this week, and we'll chat again next week.
Okay, look forward to it, mate. See ya.
Thanks to Minia for that. And if you'd like to read those stories we've just discussed, point your browser at zdnet.com.au/news. It's time now for this week's feature interview with Graham Nielsen of Aura Software Security in New Zealand. Graham's done a lot of work with BlackBerries to the point where he's actually developed a Trojan for the mobile device he uses during security audits. I caught up with him a couple of months ago for this interview. How easy is it to own a BlackBerry?
Well, by default, it's very easy. By default, there are security mechanisms, IT policies, application controls that you can switch on. But by default, a default install, if you're running a corporate BlackBerry Enterprise server, by default, it's easy. You're allowed to download third-party apps, install them, and therefore install anything. Which
but wait a minute, BlackBerry apps are signed.
Well, they are, but to get the keys to sign your applications is pretty trivial. It's not a good key distribution method. You basically go to the website, fill out a form, pay $100 US, and they will email you a set of keys. So, sure, they will have policy for revoking those keys. You need to have a credit card from somewhere. But, yeah, it's not a good key distribution method, so...
But people have actually proven this by, you know, proven that this is a problem by taking Trojan code and submitting the form, and they, sure enough, their code got signed, right?
Well, it's, they don't, RIM don't, Research in Motion, the company that own the BlackBerries, they don't actually sign the code. All they do is they send you the keys, you then sign your own code and distribute your applications, and that is the only check on what is in the code. There's no check on what's in the code. That's the only hurdle. Is the web form.
Okay, so now we know that we can actually run badware on BlackBerries. How do we get the badware onto the BlackBerry?
You can go to a website. It has a browser, so you can download it. You can email it to somebody. There's numerous ways. You can use anyone with a BlackBerry has a USB cable, so you download an application from the web, and you use the nice user-friendly software to load it onto your BlackBerry.
Okay, so basically, you know, when we're talking about these sort of Trojans, we still require the user to actually install it.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Through something like a social engineering attack, which, you know, I imagine they'd be quite susceptible to on a BlackBerry, which hasn't been a targeted platform.
Totally. It's treated more as a phone, I think. Download a cool game, run it. Why wouldn't you? Also, if in a corporate network, applications can be pushed to BlackBerries from a central server, a repository, so you know, a malicious coder, developer, could easily push out Trojan BlackBerry code to all the enterprise BlackBerries.
So basically, if someone gets into your enterprise BlackBerry server, you've got a lot of owned handsets to worry about.
You have a bunch of bot berries.
Bot berries. You're proud of that one, aren't you?
I like the berries. Yeah.
Okay. Now, once you get this badware onto the BlackBerry, what sort of stuff can you use it to do?
Well, the basic idea, which was detailed at DEF CON last year in a paper called BB Proxy, is you have a little application running which makes external connection to a nasty host that I control. Your BlackBerry always has a connection to your BlackBerry Enterprise server. It's like a VPN. So once the BlackBerry is connected back to my host, it will then act as a proxy. So I can initiate connections to other hosts, either external hosts, internal hosts, carrier hosts, depending on what carrier network you're on. I can make phone calls using your BlackBerry. I can send emails. I can read your emails. I can read the phone logs. I can gather all the information I require to then further attack other machines. So I can port scan internal machines. I can port scan external machines. I've just added a whole bunch of information gathering capability and some further functionality, as I say, allowing me to control the BlackBerry.
So you've really developed what is a Trojan for the BlackBerry.
It's kind of like a bit like back orifice, I suppose. You have a Trojan which can then connect back to an external host, and yeah, I can run commands, I can do what I like. So I mean, it's used for auditing and pen testing BlackBerry deployments, basically.
Generally, do you find people set this stuff up correctly, or is it a bit of a horror show out there?
It can be set up correctly. A lot of government departments have, you know, prescribed regulations. People understand it about what the IT policies and security mechanisms that should be set on all the BlackBerries.
What are those mechanisms? What should people do to avoid your evil badware getting onto their BlackBerries?
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of IT policies which may conflict with usability, which basically say things like allow third-party downloads or not, allow internal connections or not, allow external connections or not, what resources can applications use on the phone, so can they access the phone API, can they send out email. So you can control all those. By default, they're allowed in most cases. So all the stuff that I showed I can do in a default install. So I have to actively go in to the BlackBerry Enterprise server and trawl through the policies and set those up. So you can do it, and it's not hard if you're if you're reading the docs and following the procedures. But
Does the typical enterprise go off and switch all that stuff off, or do you find that most enterprise deployments of BlackBerries are pretty wide open and susceptible to these sorts of attacks?
It's pretty mixed. If they've had government departments generally have a set of policies prescribed by their national security agency, whatever that might be, to tell them what should be done. In the most case, they try and follow that, but they don't probably understand what they're actually doing or why they're doing it necessarily. And it often conflicts with users wanting to do things like connect up their GPS or download an application that they need and want to use. So yeah. And then other corporate, just like all software, other corporates will set them up and, hey, great, it works, no complaints, fantastic. I don't want to fiddle with it because people might start complaining.
That old chestnut.
Absolutely.
Graham Nielsen, thank you for your time.
No problem. Cheers.
Graham Nielsen there, discussing some of the security challenges you run into with the mighty BlackBerry. We do have another feature interview coming up shortly, but first it's time for our sponsor interview. Now, the way Risky Business works is simple. We sell advertisements and these sponsor interview slots so we can afford to produce the rest of the program, and there's a few larger security companies who've stepped up to the plate to help us over 2008. Now, one of those companies is Symantec, and so we've got the company's Senior Manager of Technical Product Management, Rob Pregnall, joining us for this sponsor interview. Now, as Munir and I discussed during the news, there's a nasty new Trojan floating about that can run man-in-the-middle attacks on over 400 banks worldwide. Now, that's no big deal, but it is when you realize it runs real-time man-in-the-middle attacks that make tokens just seem like nothing more than annoyingly large key rings. It renders them completely useless. Rob, what's the skinny on this latest badware, and why is it newsworthy?
I think the newsworthy aspect of this particular Trojan is simply because it has got many facets of penetration in the user's PC, by malicious code landing on the PC, combined with the ability to stage a classic man-in-the-middle attack, whereby it captures information, processes that information, and yet displays back to the user whatever the user would expect to see, regardless of what the attack is actually doing at the under the screen.
So if you're using a token, it's stiff shit, isn't it? I mean, you're still going to be affected by this.
You'll still be affected because what this particular Trojan will do is intercept the traffic at the local PC before it's encrypted,
and continue with the configuration settings that are in place for over 400 specific banks right now, continue to display to the user everything that they would expect to see.
Now, I understand the way that it works is that it actually alters the transaction amount. If you're going to deposit money in someone's account, it actually waits until it has an opportunity, until that's happened, then it alters the destination account number and the amount. Is that correct?
That's correct. And what it's really doing is steering the money away from the target or destination account that the user thinks they're paying money into, of course, into the attacker's account directly.
Yeah, and that does that in real time. So that's how it can work, even despite the two-factor authentication. But I got to say, though, it doesn't seem that this particular type of attack would get around the two-factor authentication as used by banks like Commonwealth that use SMS-based authentication.
I would, to be honest, I would also echo the fact that SMS-based authentication is still a very valid way of potentially defeating this, because it's independent of any PC-based communication.
Yeah, it's out of band.
That's right.
Yeah, and it also happens to tell you, hey, you know, enter this code to transfer, you know, this amount of money to this account. So, yeah, I suppose some people could be fooled by not double-checking, but it really seems that tokens... how much damage do you think this sort of malware, which is ready to go with templates in existence for 400 banks, none of them in Australia, we should point out, at this stage, but, you know, it could just be a matter of time. How much damage do you think this does to the credibility of tokens as a, you know, as a viable defence mechanism?
I think it raises a valid question that we continue to require ongoing technology solutions, of security solutions, I should say, which continue to need to evolve to stay abreast. Tokens remain effective. You mentioned SMS mechanisms as well. I think the message comes through loud and clear that in the security space, we will forever need to evolve our defences to stay abreast of the attackers who are constantly finding ways to get through anything that's put in place.
Yeah, well, it's still not the end of the world, I guess, because I imagine if you put a bit of logic on the back end, you know, at the bank end, you'd be able to detect funny business using some heuristic models that look at transactions and things like that. And it really limits the attacker's opportunity. They can't just log into the account whenever they want and clear it out, can they?
No, that's right. They arguably can obviously gather account numbers and passwords through this, which does give them some of the more traditional pieces that they need to, I guess, conduct more traditional access to those accounts.
Mm.
Because they've got that information, they can do that on the fly, as you say. However, clearly, in terms of evading detection, I think that they would not do that. The nature of this attack is such, as you said, to do it in real time, which is the first step in tending to evade detection until somebody, if they ever do, comes back and checks their account details or hears from the person that should have received the money that they never did. The other thing is, I think it's important to point out here, as you mentioned, SMS-based factor authentication with transactions online, etc., is one mechanism that could defeat this, or at least prevent it from being as effective. And that comes down and reminds us that it's the people who do apply multi-layered security, the people who do, in this instance, utilize SMS-based mechanisms, will not likely be the victim. The people that will be the victim will be those who don't have those mechanisms in place, or those that don't continually monitor their accounts and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got to ask too, just in the interests of transparency, do you guys have any vested interest in pushing SMS-based authentication?
No, we don't, not at all.
You don't sell it?
No, we don't sell it. No, we don't provide it. I bank with a bank that offers it, and I signed up and I use it.
Mm.
You know, there are certain... it's not something that we do. We don't push it. We just encourage people to take advantage of whatever layer of security they can to build up an effective multi-layered security defence.
I guess another thing, Rob, that's quite alarming about this latest bit of malware... What's it called, by the way? Have you guys given it a snazzy name yet?
It's the Trojan.SilentBanker.
Hey, Silent Banker, I like it. Conjures up all sorts of images. It really is sort of built like a toolkit, isn't it? So people can actually write their own templates for different banks.
That's correct. And that's something we've seen for a good length of time now with regard to Trojans and malicious code and attacks in general that target the machines and get onto the machines, continuing to evolve once they're there. They will plant something on the computer and then continue to download new functionality, new configuration files, and so on. This particular Trojan, once in place on a machine, will in turn download an additional Trojan called Trojan Flush J, which changes DNS settings.
Is that the one that sends all the porno, force feeds the porno towards the user?
That's another aspect of it, but in this particular instance, the flush Trojan is essentially there to redirect the DNS such that you will get to, in some cases, as you say, porn, in some cases, screensavers, in some cases, obviously, just blasting through an attacker's website so that they can perform some other kind of drive-by download.
Yeah, or even redirecting them when they do a lookup for, you know, say, anz.com or whatever. anz325.com.
There you go. This also installs itself as a driver, as a MIDI driver, such that anything that uses music will be tickling the capabilities of the Trojan as well.
Mm-mm.
Anything that uses sound, I should say.
Okay, Rob, well, thanks for the rundown on that malware, and I guess we'll just have to keep an eye out and see if it spreads and see whether or not it winds up forming a decent botnet.
That's the next thing, yeah, sure.
Okay, mate, thanks again.
Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Rob Pregnell there from Symantec, our sponsor for this week's show. Coming up next is our final feature interview, and it's with Larry Block, the chief executive of Australian domain name reseller and hosting provider NetRegistry. The crafty devils at NetRegistry got a hold of the au.com domain some time ago and have been selling subdomains off au.com for many years. It seems a reasonable alternative to registering a .com.au domain, which back in the day was very expensive and a bit of a runaround. Now, this is where it gets interesting, is some doofus has stepped in and registered, wait for it, .com.au.com. So the owner of that domain has inserted a wildcard DNS entry there. So if you try to go to itradio.com.au, for example, and you accidentally put a .com on the end, which can happen when you're using browsers with autocomplete features, you, of course, wind up going to itradio.com.au.com, which, because of the wildcard this doofus has put there, redirects to an advertisement for an anti-adware product. So try putting .com on the end of any Australian website address, like searchsecurity.com.au.com, and you'll see what I mean. So you'd think that's no biggie, right? It's just an ad. Well, you want to go have a look yourself, because the ad itself could be regarded as a bit misleading. It's one of those pages that's designed to look like a browser error. You know, your computer has a problem, you must install this software, etc. It's probably not criminal, but it's not nice either. And this led me to question NetRegistry's Larry Block on what the provider of a domain name can, can't, should, and shouldn't do in these situations. I started off by asking him if he thinks the ad's misleading too.
Yep, look, potentially. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of people out there doing all kinds of things on the internet, and you know, certainly the system, the structure that's been set up as you described is potentially misleading.
Okay. And really, are you in a position to do anything about that?
Look, we are and we aren't. You know, obviously, as the administrator of the A.com domain and its subdomain name registrants, we have a policy which is around acceptable use and damage to our reputation, as you would expect. And so, I mean, from a technical point of view, obviously we can register and deregister names at will, but you know, we provide a stable service to our registrants, and it's a rules-based service in that as long as they satisfy the rules, they can expect a right to an unfettered use of the subdomain name that we provide to them. So in the absence of any overriding concern, for example, illegal activity or activity that's clearly not satisfying community norms, and this may be an example of that, in the absence of that, we'll literally let registrants, you know, carry on as they see fit, much the same as any other namespace. You know, we would have a look at this in some detail and evaluate whether there is some overriding concern. Look, in the instance, if an authority, a legal authority, the police say, or some such were to contact us and say, we think there's something illegal here, we'd like you to suspend the domain name while it's being investigated, we would comply. That actually has never happened, to my knowledge.
Are you still looking into this one, though? I mean, are you still considering some form of action? Or
We will. We'd like to contact the Register and find out from them exactly what their intentions are and how they see what they're doing and what their defence is. You know, what we won't do is knee-jerk. You know, we can't just go and deregister names or suspend names on the basis of one side of an argument. So,
are you concerned there could be some sort of legal action if you did do something like that?
Look, I think I think our terms and conditions probably protect us from any legal action, and we would always operate within our own terms and conditions. I don't know if I'm concerned as much with legal action as I am with the libertarian perspective, if you like, which is that, you know, unless there's something actually illegal occurring or significantly against what we understand to be community norms, we don't want to be, we're not a censor. You know, we're not out there to restrict, control, or judge content that's being provided on the internet. And, you know, that's not just for the au.com domain name. I think the same applies within Com.au. You know, it is not the job of registrars or registries to police the content being provided on the internet in part through the use of a particular domain name.
Tricky situation.
It is potentially tricky. I'll tell you what is tricky. What is definitely tricky is being forced into a situation of regularly having to make those judgments. What is a lot less tricky is to specify a set of rules under which people can use a technical service that we provide and then stand back. You know, and it's much like an internet service provider. You may as well, you've obviously contacted Net Registry about this, but you could very well go to the registrant of this domain name's hosting provider and say, hey, look, you've got a guy hosting content on your network. This is what he's doing. What are you going to do about it? And I'm pretty sure that whoever's hosting that, and it may well be us, I haven't checked, but whatever the hosting company is hosting this content on com.au.com, they're going to say, well, you know, we provide a hosting service.
Mm.
You know, people are free to use our hosting service in any way they wish, so long as it doesn't bring our organisation into disrepute or contravene any laws.
Okay, well, Larry Block, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Patrick. Show me the world.
You show me the world. Net Registry CEO Larry Block there. And thanks to listener David Gossain from Webwise Design for tipping us on that story. If you've got any news tips to share with us, call me directly on 0411 696 384. Or send me an email at patrick@dotbob.net, and that's P-A-T-R-I-C-K @dotbob.net. And that's it for this week's Risky Business. Don't forget to subscribe. You've heard the drill. You all know about it. Go and join our Facebook group. It's the Risky Business Security Podcast Facebook group. It needs more members. It's only got about 18. And until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. If perception is all about resistance, you give me something to look up to it. You must admit at first, you did expect the worst. And now you show me the world, what's a beautiful words. And I couldn't find the words, you needed to be heard. No, you show me the world, you show me the world. And I must admit at first, you did expect the worst. And now you show me the world, what's a beautiful words. And I couldn't find the words, needed to be heard. No, you show me the world, you show me the world.